us in the past 6 years. This year, we continue the tradition of inviting leaders from the academia, business, and politics. For change, we have a new logo, which you can read about in the brochure. We are also experimenting with new ideas, such as more discussion sessions and a larger panel on the topic of social policy with both speakers and commentators. The team, together with our dedicated collaborators, sponsors, supporting and media partners, has worked extremely hard in the past month to bring this intellectual feast to you. We share a vision of bridging perspectives on important and sometimes controversial issues about China, and sincerely hope you will enjoy your journey with us today. Now, let us welcome our first keynote speaker, Lord Turner, Senior Fellow at the Institute for New Economic Thinking. Lord Turner, please.
Well, good morning, everybody. It's a great pleasure to be here, and I'll think of something to say while they're sorting out the slides. I thought that was incredibly impressive and set out a very clear sense of both the achievements of China, the changes in policy, and some of the major challenges. What I want to focus on, as it says on this chart, is the macro challenges of China, and to put that within a global context. Because I think it's important as we try to understand the challenges for the Chinese economy over the next few years and the impact of the Chinese economy on the rest of the world, it's important to understand that China has to achieve a transition which no other developing country has managed to achieve. And that is to go from lower middle income to middle income to higher income country as a catch-up country while being very big. And that is very different. It's a very different challenge from that of the medium-sized countries like Korea or Japan or smaller countries like Taiwan, which achieved that transition in the past. The sheer size relative to the global economy creates a different sort of challenge. And it's about that that I'd like to talk. I want to begin, though, however, with a context, some comments on the overall global economic situation, because I think it's important to understand that as a background for the challenges which China faces. In 2008, we had an enormous financial crisis, and since that, the recovery of the global economy has been far slower than we then anticipated. Why is that? I think the most fundamental reason is, I think the most fundamental reason for that is summarized on this chart. It is the increase in the total level of credit, and in this case it is private sector credit, in the developed economies, which had occurred not only over the previous 5 years, but over the previous 60. In 1950, the level of private sector credit as a percentage of GDP in the rich developed economies was 50%. By 2008, it had reached 170%. And the fundamental reason why the world economy has spent 7 years attempting, but only slowly recovering from, the great financial crisis of 2008 is the scale of the debt overhang in the world created by that growth of leverage over the previous 60 years. Now, why does that matter? Why does leverage matter? If all of credit in an economy was extended for the reasons that our economic textbooks suggest, which is extended to finance capital investment and good capital investment, which produces cash flow to pay back the debt, then we needn't be worried about the level of leverage, because whatever the level of leverage, it would be a good level of leverage and a sustainable level of leverage. But actually, if you look at how credit is extended in rich developed economies, the majority of it, the vast majority of it, is extended against one thing, which is property development and property investment. About 70 or 80% of all credit in rich developed economies and all of this increase in credit essentially funds a competition for the ownership of the land on which locationally specific property sits. And the problem with that is that when you essentially have credit extended against a scarce supply good, which is locationally specific land, the more credit you extend, the only thing that can give is the price of the land, the price of the property, and that then generates a belief, both on the part of borrowers and lenders, that it's a good idea to borrow more money and to lend more money, and we get these extraordinary strong cycles of credit and asset prices, but it is particularly property asset prices, which are not just part of the story of financial instability in the modern world, they are the whole of the story of financial instability in the modern world. Now, those cycles go in a very powerful fashion, and we've seen them in Scandinavia in the early 1990s, in the US residential mortgage market in the 2000s, but the biggest one we ever saw of this cycle was Japan in the 1980s. The cycle of credit and property development and property investment in Tokyo and other major cities. And what then happened in Japan in the 1990s and the 2000s was simply, as it were, a dress rehearsal for what has happened in the global economy after 2008. Because when a property boom, a credit-fueled property boom, bursts, and this cycle just spins into reverse and goes the other way, with falling credit supply, falling credit demand, and falling property prices, you enter an environment in which it is very difficult to keep your economy going. Because you have a whole load of people who have such high levels of debt, corporates or households, that they are determined to pay down debt. So what you get is the phenomenon shown on the red line on this chart, which is Japanese private non-financial corporates, Japanese companies, which would typically, as they were before 1990, be net borrowers from the financial system, who turn into net lenders to the financial system. The red line goes from negative to positive. And what they are doing is attempting to pay down their debt. And you end up with what Richard Koo, in a very fine book, has called a balance sheet recession, where over-leveraged household or companies are so determined to pay down debt that even if the central bank reduces the interest rate to effectively zero, they still don't want to borrow more money. Now, in that environment, of course, what will tend to happen is that the government moves into a deficit, and that is the blue line on the chart, the Japanese government going from a surplus to a deficit, and that is useful, and it helps to offset the demand depression effect of private sector deleveraging. But it has the inevitable consequence that the total amount of government debt just goes up and up and up. And that, again, you can see this is now the stock figure, not the flow figure, the corporates slowly deleveraging, the general government getting more and more delevered. And what happens after we have had an increase of leverage which gets to excessive levels is you enter an environment where fundamentally we don't know how to get rid of debt. We simply know how to shift it around the economy from the private sector of the economy to the public sector of the economy. And that pattern, which we saw in Japan from 1990 onwards, is exactly what has happened to the rest of the developed world over the last 7 years since the financial crisis. You can see it here. The households beginning to, this is the all developed economies together, a slight deleveraging of household sectors after the previous increase, mainly in the US, a flattening out of the private non-financial corporates, but their attempts to delever have been offset by increases in public debt, so that total debt, total leverage across the overall developed world has not come down since 2008. It's simply gone up and up and up. We shift debt around the economy. In developed economies, we shift it from private to public sector, but once we've got too much debt, we really don't know how in economics to get rid of it. But we also shift debt across economies across the world, and in particular, what we've done is shift them a little bit from the developed markets to the emerging markets. So that what has happened since 2008 is that the increase of the leverage of the developed markets has at least slowed down, but emerging market debt has shot up. And within emerging market debt, that is absolutely dominated by China. There's been some increase in some countries like Turkey, Brazil, other emerging markets are in the average. But the dramatic fact is that the Chinese level of leverage, there are various different ways you can measure it, but on this one, it was roughly flat at about 150% of GDP in the 10 years before 2008, and then it shot up and has now reached about over 200% of GDP today. This, in fact, I think the figure I've got here is on what's called the total social finance measure. Other people put it going from 150 to 250. It depends on exactly what figures but you use. But basically, an enormous increase in Chinese leverage. Now, why did that increase occur? That increase occurred essentially, I think, because it reflects the huge challenge that the Chinese government and policymakers have, which is how to grow to middle-income and high-income countries when you are a very, very big country. We sometimes talk in economic development as if catch-up with developed economy levels is inevitable, that it's bound to occur. But actually, if you track back economic history over the last half century and ask how many countries have managed to succeed from far behind the developed economy leaders, how many of them have managed to get all the way to rich country living standards, you will find, first of all, some countries like Qatar or Abu Dhabi, but they're irrelevant to most people. They're small population, natural resource countries. You will also find Singapore and Hong Kong, but these are city states. These are countries with 5 or 10 million population, and the economic paths to development available to them are quite different from those of large countries. There are only 3 countries, Taiwan, Korea, and Japan, which have effectively, and even Taiwan's not really complete, really gone all the way to rich country standards of living while having relatively large populations. And all of them essentially did it with one economic model, which was export-led manufacturing. And that, of course, was the model which China rode for quite some time. And in particular, it rode it not only in the 1980s and 90s, but dramatically after 2000, after the reforms of Premier Zhu Rongji and the breakup of the old inefficient state-owned manufacturing enterprises and the entry into the WTO, what we get is an extraordinary explosion of Chinese export performance, which we can see summarized in this chart, the amazing growth of Chinese current account surplus as a percent of Chinese GDP. And when you look back at it, it is an enormous effect, going from about 2% back in 2000 and reaching a peak of 10% in 2007, before the crisis. And that was a very successful development path. The trouble is that it makes it vulnerable if you then have a major shock to your export markets. And the core of what happened after 2008-09, and the core of why we get that extraordinary increase in Chinese leverage, is a response of the Chinese government to the fear that the slowdown in their export markets is going to shock the Chinese economy. Now, China has to be far more worried about those sort of shocks and about reliance on exports than, for instance, Japan or Korea ever had to be worried back in 1960 or 70 when they were at the same level of GDP per capita. And that is because China is big, and therefore it is a much bigger percentage of the global economy. And it has become dramatically a much bigger percentage of the global economy. This is not on fancy purchasing power parity figures. This is on market exchange rates. China, as a percentage of the global economy on market exchange rates, has gone from 3% in 2000 and will reach over 13% this year, 2015. And the problem is that the bigger you are relative to the global economy, the less, as a simple exercise of mathematics, it is possible to measure, to grow your economy simply by the export-led model. There is simply isn't enough of the rest of the world to do it. And the crucial thing here is that although on the previous chart we saw that the Chinese current account surplus has come way down as a percentage of China GDP, though it's shot up in the last 6 months, when you do it as a measure of global GDP, the reduction is less, and indeed it looks like in 2015 we could be back with China at the same level of reliance on the global economy as it was back at the peak in 2007. Now, this is the context within which we had the 2009 credit stimulus. The determination of the Chinese authorities to say we can no longer rely on the external demand of the rest of the world to grow our economy because they've gone into crisis. And if you go back to early 2009, the Chinese authorities are worried about the impact of that on employment, with signs that after the Chinese New Year, people might not be rehired into the factories, etc. And therefore, the Chinese authorities unleash an attempt to grow domestic demand. But the only way that you can really quickly grow domestic demand is to hit the credit lever and hit the investment lever. So what happens after 2009 is that extraordinary increase in credit and leverage that I showed you, and also an extraordinary increase in investment as a percent of GDP. Back in 2005, 2006, people used to say of China, this is a very strange economy, it's unbalanced, right? It has too much investment and not enough consumption. Now, in fact, at that stage, the investment rate at about 40% or so of GDP, the green line there, was still not completely out of line with the level that Korea or Japan had been in 1960 or 70. It was towards the upper end of the historical range of models, but it wasn't out of line of it. But having talked for years about an economy which had to rebalance from investment to consumption, what happened after 2009 that it became more imbalanced. It became more dependent on investment, and that increase of the investment rate from about 42% of GDP to almost 50% of GDP, that is unparalleled in economic history. We just have not had large economies investing close to 50% of GDP. And this investment is to an extraordinary extent focused on infrastructure and property. There's a fine analysis by the Hong Kong Institute of Monetary Research based at the HKMA, which illustrates that while we sometimes say that the Chinese economy has a real estate sector which is 15% of the economy, if you track it through an input-output model and work out which of the industries are fundamentally dependent on the property sector, sectors like concrete and cement and steel, you will find that about 33% of the Chinese economy is essentially infrastructure development, property development, and the supporting industries. And of the credit which has been extended, something like 40% of all the credit which has been extended is fundamentally supporting property developments. And here's what's interesting about this. I showed earlier that in the rich developed world, we had that huge increase in credit, and I said that most of that increase in credit had to do with property and locationally specific land. If you went back to Korea or Japan in 1960 or 70 or 75, you would not find that most credit was then about property development. Most credit was then to manufacturing industry to buy plant and equipment. China has, at a far earlier stage of economic development, a far lower level of GDP per capita, ended up with an infrastructure and property-focused economy. And you can see that when you look at the growth of urban employment, and you find that whereas there has been a growth in manufacturing employment, the bit which is really dramatic is the increase in the number of people who are employed in the construction industry. Now, all of that creates a vulnerability, as many people, probably all the people in this room know. In China, we have this amazing swathe of building, of properties, apartments, railways, roads, and we have the extraordinary phenomenon of all the different cities competing with one another to build urban infrastructure. I mean, wherever I go in China, I find that the local government tells me that if only they build a convention centre and a sports centre and maybe a local museum and some wonderful roads, everybody will come to their city. Now, this actually creates a very significant element of vulnerability again, a vulnerability which is illustrated in this chart, the role of local governments. Because the other thing which has occurred, of course, dramatically since 2008 is a huge explosion of local government borrowing. Again, as you will well know, although often in the Western world people think of China as a deeply centralized political structure because it is a one-party system, actually, in terms of its economic structure, it involves intense competition between highly decentralized local governments, each trying to put their city or their province on the map. But those local governments, as a result of the reforms, the changes to the fiscal revenue sharing back in the 1980s and 90s, really don't have revenue streams other than, in many cases, land sales. And I said on my second chart that one of the features of modern private credit is that it can get into a cycle of more credit drives up the asset price, enables you to have more credit, makes you want to borrow more credit. Essentially, within Chinese local government, that idea has been hardwired into the local government financing pattern, so that local governments borrow money to develop land in the hope that that will drive an increase in the land back, the value of the land, which they will then sell to pay off the debts. And this, again, creates an enormous vulnerability. It's almost as if you go back to the words of the great economist Hyman Minsky, who talked about the way that credit can be extended in what he called a hedge, a speculative or a Ponzi form, and speculative and Ponzi is when they become essentially circular in nature. Essentially, the Chinese local government financing structure has taken the Minsky idea of the Minsky circle and written it into the very guts of the way that local government works. So I think China now stands at the end of 6 years of an extraordinary infrastructure boom. I think that infrastructure boom was the right thing to do. I do not think the Chinese authorities had any option back in early 2009 other than essentially to pour concrete. And my God, China's poured a lot of concrete. Somebody has worked out that between 2009 and 2012, China poured 6.6 gigatons of concrete, which is worked out to be as much as the US poured in the whole of the 20th century. I think it is almost impossible to underestimate the sheer scale of this infrastructure investment. It is infrastructure investment, it is credit finance. It was necessary in order to prevent the shock to the export-led model, which was going to be driven by post-crisis debt overhang and deleveraging in the global economy, but it has enormous risk and it is not a permanent answer to the fundamental challenge which China faces. China has to find a way of shifting, yes, from overseas demand to domestic demand, But that domestic demand cannot be simply more infrastructure development. It cannot be 50% of GDP being invested, and it cannot be this enormous focus on property and infrastructure development. Now, some people say, well, yes, Adair, you're right, but, you know, there's still a long way to go. If I was to look at Chinese capital stock per capita, it's still a long way below American or European or Japanese levels. So eventually, they say, there'll be a danger of overinvestment in infrastructure, but not now. I think that counter-argument is too optimistic. I'm absolutely certain that there are some cities and urban areas of China, Shanghai and Beijing, where there is an enormous amount of further investment to come. But I think it will be increasingly the case that if the investment boom in infrastructure goes on, we will see large amounts of spare capacity and bad debts in second and third and fourth tier cities. And indeed, we have already seen it over the last 6 months, where there is clearly a very major slowdown going on in Chinese property development, infrastructure development, and as a result, in the heavy industrial sectors. Now, of course, there is more to go in terms of urban population. The urban population has gone from somewhere in the mid-40s in 2005 to the latest figure is about 53%, and there is an official target of 60% by 2020. And I'm sure that urbanisation will continue. I do, however, want to make two points about urbanisation. It is sometimes presented in Chinese discussions of economic development as if urbanisation is an end in itself, which will itself produce higher productivity. But that is not the case. There's nothing about somebody moving from a rural location to an apartment block that makes them more productive. And if you look at Korea and Japan at the same stage of economic development, nobody ever talked then about urbanization as a specific policy objective. They talked about industrialization as a specific policy objective. And there is a danger that the focus on urbanization as an end per se has produced a bias in the Chinese development model towards the concrete pouring infrastructure investment bias within the system. I think we will increasingly realise that we are quite far advanced in China with urbanisation. At some stage, that will produce, particularly if there is liberalisation of the hukou system and people are allowed increasingly to live where they want, that will end up with us realising that although there are more investment needs in some major cities, Beijing, Guangzhou, Shanghai, that there are others where there will be spare capacity. And at that stage, we will also realise that the sheer level of Chinese debt, and here it's on a slightly different set of figures, going up to 282%, is already quite high, even compared with at least some of the developed markets. So the challenge that China now has within the global context and being such a large economy is that it has to move to forms of domestic aggregate demand which are not investment and infrastructure and indeed are consumption. That, of course, requires two things. It requires a reduction in the extraordinary high household savings rates and corporate savings rates, which requires reform of the social security system to reduce the need for precautionary savings. It also requires reform of the state-owned enterprises to require the state-owned enterprises nominally owned by the Chinese people to pay dividends to their nominal owner. At the moment, this is a very interesting phenomenon, Chinese state-owned enterprises, of companies which don't appear to pay much to their nominal owner. So there are things to do to reduce the savings rate. But clearly what also has to happen is an increase in wages and an end to the remarkable reduction in the labour income share in China, which we have seen over the last 10 to 15 years. Let me end, however, with a suggestion that in the challenge of achieving that, something may be about to come to the aid of the Chinese authorities, and that something is demographic change. We have already seen, of course, a very major shift in the balance of rural employment and urban employment, with, on the official figures, the urban employment about to overtake rural. And up until now, people have always said of China, ah, yes, there's been a lot of jobs created, but there's still an awful lot of people in the countryside. There is still a large amount of rural population to move, and that will continue to depress wages for many years to come. I think we're probably on the verge of a change where that is no longer the case. For two reasons. First of all, demographic change is going to produce a fall in the number of overall population quite soon, of the working age population, but in particular, it is producing a dramatic fall in the number of young people entering the workforce for the first time. So if we look at the number of 15 to 30-year-olds compared with 2010, by 2025, it will be down by 30%. And this is, I think, going to produce a tightening of the Chinese labour market faster than many people have realised. In addition, however, when people say, ah, yes, but there are still lots of people left in the countryside, lots of people left in rural employment, the only point I would make in that is, yes, but an increasing number of those are quite old. If you look at the rural employment population and divide it between below 50 and above 50, the total amount of rural employment has come down through urbanisation, but the number less than 50-year-old has come down even faster. And the crucial thing about older than 50, or maybe even older than 40, is I don't think they'll ever migrate. People like that don't migrate. They typically stay where they are, they live whatever life they can, but they don't migrate. So my final thought is that the Chinese have an enormous challenge to achieve a rebalancing of the economy towards consumption, and that in relation to that, demography both increases the need but may provide the answer. It increases the need because with the slowing of the Chinese demography, we are going to get to the stage where if China simply goes on pouring concrete, it will pour too much concrete. It will have too much infrastructure relative to its population needs, in particular in parts of the area. And therefore, the slowdown of the population in itself tells us that the urbanisation-driven model, the infrastructure investment-driven model, has got to come to an end. But the demographic slowdown, particularly among young people, will also be part of the answer, because it will tighten the labour market, drive up wages, and therefore produce the thing which China crucially needs, which is domestic consumption demand. China, unlike Korea and unlike Japan, cannot get rich simply as an export-driven economy. It's simply too big relative to the world to do that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lord Turner, for your inspiring presentation. Please put your hands together to welcome our next keynote speaker, Mr. John Hughes, the Group Political Advisor of BP. Mr. Hughes, please.
Good morning. Nu shi men, shan shi men, da jiao hao. Wo jiao Hughes John, and for the sake of my Chinese colleagues, that's the last Mandarin you'll hear of me today. I am John Hughes, and I happen to be on the advisory board for the Confucius Institute here at the LSE. I'm on the Court of Governors of the School and the board of the Great Britain China Centre. At the moment, I work for BP as their Group Political Advisor, but I happen to be leaving next month and going freelance. Now, I have two questions for the audience. You all must answer, because I will adjust my speech accordingly. Who is either a member of staff or is studying at the LSE? Okay. And who regards themselves as Chinese? Okay, my role is to advise a large company on political risk and political issues. How do we understand the risks and create mitigations? I'm also going to give you some little hints, if you're at the LSE, to how you can use this to get jobs with Western companies. Now, among the most important countries I had the pleasure of working with is China. Now, I work for an international company, and I think international companies do indeed have huge resources at our disposal. We have wide-ranging expertise, cutting-edge technology. We often have access to large-scale finance. But these companies can be perceived as rather strange animals in this globalized world. But we're not as omnipotent as many believe. It's effective interaction between us and governments that can create economic development and the subsequent benefits for society at large. However, the world we are all in is changing. 3 of the 10 largest companies are now Chinese, and these state-owned enterprises also rely on effective governments and stable societies. So first, allow me to share a view of how international companies view the world. Then I will consider some views of China. BP and global companies like it have no democratic mandate. No one anywhere has elected us to do anything. We don't take office underpinned on a raft of campaign pledges. The only formal voters we have are shareholders. And they, above all, look for performance and value for money. However, the people inside these large corporations are invariably driven by high principles and values, though we do make mistakes. We believe in open, meritocratic societies in which ideas and knowledge move freely with a clear system of law and intellectual property rights. We believe in open, law-based societies, and they imply other things. Open markets, so we can apply our skills on the basis of the efficient allocation of capital. A liberal trade regime. Developments that benefit communities rather than just individuals. Equitable tax rules and fair and enforceable regulations. More often than not, such societies are stable, and frankly, stable societies, in our view, provide the best conditions for long-term economic development. What's the relationship between a company and a government? Companies bring capital, technology, know-how, and the standards of our behaviour. Governments lead on the rule of law, legal stability, an independent judiciary, physical infrastructure, human capability development, transparency, action on corruption, and the standards of legal rights. If governments are good and effective, then the economic benefit of international companies is more likely to be so. Now let's focus on China. Now, China's on everyone's lips, and Adair has just given a lovely expose of the economics. For this audience, I don't think I need to describe the importance and magnitude of the country, but I want to give you a view of the country from an international company perspective. Now, while I work at an energy company based in London, many of these views are gathered from many corporate colleagues, so please don't ascribe them just to BP. This is the bit that's helpful if you're a student. My core message is that there are three reasons that large companies should think about their strategy to do with China. Firstly, it's because of their investments, capital employed, and purchasing in China. Secondly, it is because of the joint ventures and direct and indirect partnerships they have with China globally. Thirdly, and most importantly, it's because any global corporation needs China to succeed. If China trips, the world will trip. If the world trips, any large company will face problems. Allow me to describe each of these in turn. Firstly, doing business in China. Two contrasting narratives that I believe are both true here and both at times poorly communicated. These narratives are about the investment climate and how it feels to invest in China. This part of the narrative on the investment climate is not always positive at the moment. The economic situation is clearly evolving rapidly for both domestic companies as well as foreign ones. According to the recent American Chamber survey, their members report declines in revenue and profitability growth in China. China is increasingly viewed as just one of many investment possibilities rather than the priority. Current attitudes towards the business environment in China represent the continuation of a trend that has been developing over the last few years, and perhaps a healthy reassessment of expectations. Foreign investment in China grew by 1.7% last year, compared to 5.3% the previous year. However, on the flip side, more than three-quarters of members are optimistic about the next 2 years. The old way of investing in China no longer works. Many investors talk about the old paradigm. China needed capital, know-how, technology, and access. Companies that invested and provided at least one or two of these could succeed if they did it well. Now, the competition globally and nationally has changed, and the country's needs have also changed. This has created a very different investment environment. The country no longer needs capital or know-how in the same way, though some elements remain, but there are different aspects of technology and global access that Chinese companies still need. They are also growing global brands rapidly. This means that the investment environment for global companies is different and more demanding. The government wants to make their national champions more competitive, more innovative, and more skilled at working in China, as well as Africa, Latin America, Europe, and the US, while clearly playing to their existing strengths in Asia. Now, the other side of this narrative about doing business in China is that the government has clearly initiated a series of reforms that are profound in their magnitude and likely impact. This explains why many companies report optimism about the future. These changes taking place at the moment are critical, and 2015 could be the key year. The government has the closing year of the 12th five-year plan, and the next five-year plan could start from a very different place. The economic reforms are key, and along the drive on corruption, the government is implementing the rule of law in new ways. This potential deregulation does, of course, need to come with appropriate regulatory oversight and industry self-discipline mechanisms. We should be mindful that this drive against corruption is good, but it can perversely slow down economic growth in the short term. What has this meant for a company like BP? We have over 1,200 employees, nearly 4,000 joint venture staff, and 9,000 contractors in a range of established partnerships. However, our capital invested has actually slightly fallen from a peak of $5 billion to nearer $4.5 billion. Not bad, but we would like to do more in commercial and material projects, especially in exploration. I recall being in China at one point and describing a situation to a Chinese colleague where my water supply at home came from a French-owned company, my bank was Spanish, my mobile phone was French, and my utilities were German. and I was working for a company that had a shareholding from the Chinese state. The key question here is whether the government would lead the country's investment climate in the direction of the UK or a more protectionist country. Will foreign investors learn how to operate in this reformed China and have an even more level playing field in the future, or where they lose the ability to bring their strengths to the marketplace and be gradually squeezed out of being able to provide their know-how, technology, access and expertise. In summary, doing business in China has got harder, but there is now much hope for the future as China reforms and creates opportunities, but also uncertainty. So secondly, doing business with China. This part is more important and larger than the first, at least for BP. We have exploration and production partnerships with three main Chinese national oil companies in Indonesia, Australia, Angola, the UK, Argentina, and Iraq. We are also proud to have the Chinese government held equity in BP amounting to over 2%. China started investing in BP in 2007 and has gradually grown. So while our investments in China have never gone above $5 billion, the investments with China globally have already grown to over $15 billion. Now, this aspect for an international company is critical, and too many companies are overlooking the kind of mutual benefit that can be brought by working together outside of China. We believe that we can provide real value to the Chinese state by both them investing in BP as well as joint venturing with us in other countries. However, make no mistake, China and Chinese SOEs are very economically savvy and drive good deals for China. One can look at the recent Russia-China gas deal after so many years of discussion. This working together in other countries hopefully brings financial benefits to both sides of shareholders. Interestingly, if BP does well, then the Chinese state also does well, given it owns a sizable part of the company. Our partnerships also provide benefits for the countries where we operate. It also creates benefits in a variety of other ways. BP gets to learn from Chinese staff by working with them in Iraq or having them seconded to us in London. We build close relations and share our experience of technical issues, the Chinese supply chain, and performance-driven approach on costs. We also share and learn about non-technical issues, how we both manage security, political, community affairs in other parts of the world. With the going-out strategy, the three national oil companies have collectively spent more than $130 billion acquiring, investing in overseas assets since 2008, in pursuit of energy security for China, a laudable aim. These companies are integrated global players with the capability and financial strength. They are seeking cooperation and partnerships. This is being played out across many SOEs, providing opportunities for Western companies to partner with them across the world. So this second theme is thus larger than the first, to many but not all companies. And at times I think some companies will forget just how large it is and how it's getting larger. For BP, it's slightly more obvious because of the shared joint ventures. For other companies, they will frequently have a myriad of indirect partnerships with Chinese companies in their global operations, and often they're not aware of the magnitude and importance of making it work well. Finally, we come to the third theme. As I said at the outset, all companies rely on a stable and successful world order. As a global corporation, we need successful governments to create an operating environment where we can thrive. China is a key part of this world, and BP looks to teams in Brussels, Washington DC, and London just as importantly as the team in Beijing to help us understand the world. What China has achieved in economic growth and development over the last 20 years has been really impressive. As the country now leads the changes for quality, not just quantity, and the government moves the economy towards greater reliance on domestic demand, as Adair was talking about, and less on exports, the challenges are great. I'm lucky. I sit on the audit committee of this great university. not looking at risks for the country of China. The leadership have to look out for growth in public and private debt, environmental challenges, rising expectations, while still providing the infrastructure, human capacity, education, health, legal, welfare delivery that all governments try to give. Total Chinese trade rose 3.4% in 2014, compared with an annual goal of 7.5%. Meanwhile, the economy is expected to have grown by between 7.2% and 7.4%. The last time Chinese growth was below 7.5% was 1990. Having said that, all of the Chinese economy is performing better than nearly every other big country. Should we be worried or not? The low oil price will, of course, be helping China, while being less helpful to certain other major oil-exporting countries. China is the world's largest importer. However, it has price controls in oil inside the country, so the 50% slide in Brent crude prices since June shrink to just half of that in China itself. If China were to trip, the whole world would know about it. If China tripped, the whole world would trip. If the world trips, then international companies like BP would trip. So this third perspective is therefore the most important for companies, but of course not one that we control. Our role is to invest, obey the law, provide goods and services, and become a part of every society where we operate. We, of course, must also make money. We will always look for ways to build trust and credibility with our Chinese partners and play a role to help support the creation of technology and expertise for the long term. BP has been engaged with China's energy and chemical research and development activities for well over 10 years and invested over $40 million in doing it. We've contributed to Chinese society to help address local issues. An example is we're honoured to support the recently launched Schwarzman Scholars Programme at Tsinghua, designed to inspire the next generation of global leaders. We've invested $25 million, and the aim is to have 200 students a year. I hope someone in this room will be able to be one of them. China has shown the world over its long history it has the ability to overcome what might seem to be insurmountable problems, whether they be economic, social, political, environmental, or systemic. We should all have confidence that the government will find a Chinese way to overcome, that then international investors can play their constructive part in the future. Finally, international companies like BP rely on good government. That's why I like the LSE, perhaps the premier institution to develop public governance capability. Good luck to you all. 谢谢.